If you listen to the show, you already know that we cannot exist without our sponsors. They are the ones who make things happen behind the scenes. So let's acknowledge Fuji Sports. We've been working with these guys for a while now, not only as far as this podcast is concerned, but also at the Roll Academy. We've had their gear. I personally use their gis. What a phenomenal product.
Yeah, I mean, jiu-jitsu, judo, MMA, tape, bags, anything you need for your jiu-jitsu journey, you can find at fujisports.com.
Let's talk Roll TV. There's so much content on there. It's ridiculous at this point. But I think what is even more intriguing, as time went on during the project, we've been recording most of the events that were taking place here at Roll Academy. At this point, I mean, we have guys like Chris Howder, Armin Fadi, Rafael Lovato Sr., and Pete the Greek. I mean, there were so many different events that we've kind of recorded at. Don't you think that's amazing? I mean, points of reflection and kind of going back for all the students to see what really happened and refresh their memory.
Yeah, I think it's great, you know, being able to go back and look at all these high-level practitioners, Octavio Cudo, like one of the names you didn't mention. And I mean, just these guys that have been doing this for so long come in, teach these amazing seminars and workshops, and it's all recorded and there for you to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to get an additional savings on all this, type in code ROLLRADIO at the coupon and get additional 30% off of your membership.
Nice. Go to rollacademy.tv. What's up, everyone, and welcome back. If you haven't already, please remember to hit the like, share, subscribe, download, listen, and whatever other button there is, and leave us a review wherever you do listen. That ensures that we can continue bringing you the great guests and amazing content that you have come to expect. Today's guest is a true martial artist in every sense. He is one of the most decorated martial arts instructors in the country and is a black belt or certified instructor in at least 6 different martial arts. Today, Stephen Whittier joins the show to share his decades of martial arts experience, his unique approach to training and coaching, and a ton more. Here's the Roll Radio with 4th Degree BJJ Black Belt, one of the highest ranking Muay Thai instructors on the East Coast, and a head coach with Straight Blast Gym International, as well as its director, Stephen Whittier.
Welcome to Roll Radio.
And we are live.
Yeah, here we go.
Happy Wednesday.
Halfway done with the week.
Halfway done or halfway to go?
Halfway done. Putting it all behind me.
Is that what it is?
Some weeks. Some weeks it's you're looking forward to stuff. Some weeks you can't wait to get the stuff behind you.
Right? Yeah. So yeah. Is it been bad? Is that what it
no,
is?
No, it's just been it's been busy, which is good, right?
Busy
it's
is
better
good.
Busy than not. And no, just big tasks that are getting checked off, and once they're checked off,
yeah,
it's relief, right?
You've been killing it, man.
I don't know about that. We'll find out. We'll see. If everything gets accomplished, you can say it, but we're not there yet.
Well, listen, we are working, and that's the important part, right? We establish some of the goals and continue chipping it away on and off the mat. By the way, good private this morning.
Thanks.
I'm glad you,
yeah,
you
finally you found something chipping. I'm interested in.
You mean like the jiu-jitsu stuff? Finally, uh-huh.
Yeah,
it got you interested?
Stuff. Well,
after years of doing
it, I guess I'll stick with it for a little while. But thanks. It's I like what we're doing in that private, and hopefully I can perform it, I guess, in the real situation.
I'm actually curious, and we'll ask our guests about this a little bit later, but I'm actually curious. Do you find the private lessons actually beneficial, or do you think that it's, you know, some people find it too much one-on-one focus. There's not diversity of training partners. You know, it's kind of a very different approach. I'm curious. Yeah. We never talked about that. So
I think it's something that's got to be added into. It's a supplemental. It can't be the only thing you do because then you'll never have any application for it to see if you're actually learning it. You also need to go into it with a strategy, with a plan, because I think a lot of people show up for a private and they're like, oh, I saw this thing the other day, or I saw that thing the other day.
Yeah.
Rather than having some sort of structured plan so that at the end of maybe a group of privates, when they're sparring, or competing or whatever, have gained a bunch of knowledge rather than, you know, they learned a couple cool things that they're never going to be able to apply because they don't drill them enough, or they're you know, scattered. Everything's scattered, right? You know me, I'm a scatterbrain. So if I don't if I don't stay on task, you know, I'll be asking you about those things I saw on Instagram that are pointless for me to even try.
I would actually pay to see you do Baron Bolo or some flying triangles.
Let's do it.
I'm just saying.
All right. If you're going to be my Uki, I'd love to try a flying triangle on you.
The table turned quickly on that one.
We'll do that for sure. And then we'll find out beforehand who's going to cover the classes that you're supposed to teach after I wreck your legs falling on top of you. So. All right, let's start this thing.
Let's bring our guest in right in the middle of this conversation. Steven, how are you? Thanks for being
great,
here.
Great, guys. Thank you.
First of all, are privates useful or a waste of time?
No, I think they're useful. I totally agree with what you were just saying. I think the ideal application of them is as a supplement. Or even if somebody is only getting their instruction through privates, obviously I still think they should be doing some live drilling and some rolling with diverse partners, right? Not just with the instructor. I think it depends, right? Al Bundy, was only doing privates for a long time, right? Yeah. And I guess, you know, I've heard he's actually, you know, solid. But, I think the biggest thing is if you can manage to fit jujitsu into your life and you enjoy jujitsu, you do whatever you can to be able to train it. If that's the only way you could possibly do it based on a schedule or something, then so be it. But I totally agree. A supplement is the greatest application of it because that's the time when you're already getting the collaborative laboratory aspect of training with all sorts of different training partners in the classroom environment. And now you can have just individualized attention on specific problem solving. I also agree with you that the purpose shouldn't be like, hey, cool move. I want to learn this move. That's like, well, how do you know that this even is a fit for you? Right. Like what are we talking about here? But the way I typically go about it is let's pick an area where you want to focus in on, and we've got some specific problems that we can identify that we can now solve them, preferably using a lens of first principles where we can really get down to sort of root cause rather than just focusing on the individual possibilities of, you know, oh, you could do this move or you could do this move, or I like this move, but like, what's the first thing we need to be focused on here? And that's a very productive hour or whatever you're doing for a private when people can go in there and just get what might otherwise amount to, I don't know, months or even years sometimes of just trying to figure things out in the midst of rolling. Now you can focus, zero right in on it, understand, and you can have solutions. So it can be very productive in that sense.
It's interesting conversation in general in regards to privates, because we all know that originally, way back in the day, that's how jiu-jitsu was taught.
Mm-hmm.
Group classes were introduced later on, mostly to appeal towards larger demographics and simply bring more interest into the room. But originally, mm-hmm. as it was starting, was one-on-one. Why do you think that shift took place from 100% one-on-one to now, well, probably 90% of group? And there is some small attention on private lessons, but it's not as nearly as much as group classes.
Right. I would say there's probably a number of factors there to be able to have a broader reach for sure. You know, as people start to teach professionally, that would obviously be necessary. Otherwise, you'd have no ability to scale if you're trying to do it as a profession. But I think there's probably the other aspect of it as well, which is simply in the beginning, it was probably taught a lot as, you know, here's a move, right? So we're going through like the different self-defense movements and you've kind of got those down. But now people realize really quickly as you're moving from a theoretical environment into a live environment, you know, there has to be the application. And so that's when, you know, people start to realize it's not enough for me to just be able to perform this move with my instructor, but I've got to really find out if I can do this when I've got different human beings with different body types and different levels of experience and everything who are actually trying to not let me do that move. And that changes things, right? So I think that's where it will become very valuable to have some sort of touch points with other people, right? You just need to get outside of just the bubble of, am I executing the technique properly? That's only step one, right? Then we need to have some sort of implementation mechanism.
Yeah, logic and troubleshooting and so on as old as it's going. And probably, to be honest, the cost probably is a big factor behind the class too.
Right, it'd be more expensive just privately, right?
You know, I mean, I do privates here in my academy, and I know the cost is a big factor for a lot of people, right? It's obviously the group classes are by far more affordable, even though it doesn't give you the same attention and same platform to troubleshoot and learn. So it's just different mediums. That's how I look at it.
Yes, right? Exactly.
You get different things out of them. Similar to what you mentioned, seminars, right? Before we jumped on, right? Like seminars, another medium that or different platform to learn jiu-jitsu or whatever skill you're trying to learn is, but it's very different than class, right? A normal class, 60-minute class is very different than what seminar would be with a guest at the academy. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'll cover a lot more ground in a seminar than I would ever do in a single class because, you know, I'm trying to get within reason. I don't want to do too much in a seminar. Then you dilute it. But I also want to make sure I can get enough out there that then they can go back to class and they can have time to work on it. So we'll do some, I always like to do some implementation on the seminar because one of the goals that we always have for a seminar is not just do you know more than when you walked in by the end of it, but can you actually do things that you couldn't do tested like with some resistance? Like do you actually have skill acquisition that you didn't have when you walked in? So I do like that, but there's no question, you know, you can't do the same amount of work, you know, in a seminar. If you want to cover some decent ground, then you'd be able to do in a class where I'm going to be much, much more limited in how much I'm going to cover.
Yeah, and again, I think a lot of people don't understand the unfortunately, the purpose behind each of those platforms or each of those blocks of time and how you can really maximize it. But the moment you really understand and plan it a little bit, you know, take notes, really have some takeaway, tangible takeaways, some homework for yourself to do. This is where we starting to grow. You know, not only from these individual platforms, but now we really can benefit and maximize our return behind the investments because ultimately it is our investment, right? We are investing time, we are investing financially, we are investing effort, you know, health and the whole thing, right? We're putting something in and what we're going to gain from it. That's really the return that we're talking about, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I love that too because it's kind of funny you bring that up because I always talk about, you know, depending on how you approach your training, it could either be, you know, a really kind of a limited return, or you could really bank a tremendous amount of equity. So, you know, when you show up and you kind of have that long-term approach of like how I'm actually maximizing this knowledge as opposed to just sort of collecting a ton of information. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. And I often talk to my students about this is if you come in with a plan to a class, you're maximizing your return, right? Like you can focus on something more specific versus walking into a pitch dark room and hoping you're not stepping on any Legos or bumping into things.
Right.
Like it's like chaos at this point. You're trying to avoid obstacles versus aiming for the target, right? These are two very two different mental states and approaches to the situation, right?
Yes.
Can I ask you, both of you guys, so it's obvious having a plan in going into a private or a group of privates. But if you have, if you're going in, say you're new, you're still a white belt, and you're going into a class which should be structured, right? What plan? How do you have a plan for that? I mean, other than going in and receiving knowledge, how do you maximize the class, the knowledge that you're going to get in that class?
Oh, I'm happy to share, but I'm curious what Stephen thinks about this.
Sure. So it depends on, for me, like I need context for this because first thing is what's true of me is also quite true of pretty much all the instructors in my organization because we all kind of have a shared philosophy on this. But I don't teach Stephen Whittier jiu-jitsu, right? Like, I don't teach my game. People might see that if they ask me something specifically during like an open mat or something like that. If I'm rolling with them, and especially if maybe they have certain tendencies, and I'll say, you know, how you're moving right now, I do this and you're already there. It's just a matter of, maybe I can point some things out to you, but you're already in that territory. Like, clearly your body likes to move like this. But what I don't do is teach people to be clones of me. So I think that's important for context. So knowing that, when I teach, I'm always teaching what I call like first principles jujitsu. So I'm trying to, it's not just about quote unquote, like basic techniques on like, you know, you have to learn a Kimura or, you know, so like, that's not what I mean. What I mean is sort of like the core fundamentals of the positions, the movements, what it is you're actually trying to accomplish here. Something that is going to be universal to every single student, regardless of athleticism, age, rank. That's it, right? So that's pretty much what I focus on at least 95% of the time, with just a few very qualified, like, today we're going to go off topic a little bit. I do want you guys to learn this because, say, this came up at a tournament. Somebody ran into a practitioner, or we started to see a bunch of people now kind of playing this game, and I want to make sure you're familiar with what's going on here so we can kind of reverse engineer it. So that would be like an exception. But for the most part, 95% of the time, it's just first principles jiu-jitsu. So in that sense, when they come into class, they can have it be like, well, what I'm going to do is try and actually make this work in class. And we actually facilitate that as part of the environment, because every single class, we're not going to say, here's the position and whatever movements we're teaching there. Okay, now go free roll, right? We're always going to have the intermediary step of bringing them from 0 to 100, where we're going to have adaptive progressive resistance with our drilling. So we'll do some form of positional or situational drilling, whatever term people use, to actually bridge that gap. So now they're applying it in real time, not full out, but first light resistance, then moderate. Then if they're still doing the movements correctly and having success, then their partner's instruction is to now get up to a point where it becomes quite competitive, right? So trying to find exactly where along the chain that you're having problems, so you can really diagnose, like problem solve right at that point. And that will be basically making sure that they have application of what they learned in class. So there is a target. It's kind of built into the model. The other side of it is, let's say that it's open mat and we're rolling. So what I will tell people is that I will always come in with maybe just one or two objectives. And that's what I'm specifically looking for when I'm rolling. So in other words, you know, I'm not taking classes very much myself. So I enforce this into my roles, and that's how I get my isolation training. Basically, my situational training is, a lot of times I'm once in a while, I just grab somebody and say, hey, can we do like 5 minutes, 10 minutes on this? And then we'll switch. But a lot of times I institute it and implement it into the rolling itself. So I'll get my reps by just focusing on one thing over and over again. And just as an example of that, I just filmed like my course on first principles open guard, right? And so I was telling the story how when I was working on this material, every single role I did, almost without exception for over a year, I started laying on my back, no upright guard, laying on my back, working on this particular aspect. And that kicked off every single role I did, right? That made it easy too, because I didn't have to really rely on somebody else for that. That meant that I could actually, I mean, I did a few like, you know, stand up grappling rounds too, so I wouldn't like lose that part. But I wanted to focus primarily on my open guard, first retention, then starting to layer in the offense using these principles that I wound up later turning into curriculum and teaching. But I just made sure that before I disseminated that information, I had so many reps that I had everything mapped out of like, this is what's going to happen at this stage. This is what's going to happen. You know, it's going to be two or three things that every human being is going to do, because now I've experienced it all. And now we kind of come and we have the whole curriculum laid out. And so that's another thing that I'll tell people is, you know, pick an objective, even if it's just for one day, right? All you're going to do is come in, like Thomas is saying, with an objective for this rolling session. You don't try and conquer everything. Anything else aside from this one objective is a bonus. But now you're really solving specific problems, because if you were relying on just, hey man, rolling and whatever happens, well, there's going to be so many things, so many areas that you don't never get to, right? Like if you want to work on mount escapes, right? What if nobody ever mounts you, or you want to work on mount, but like nobody ever lets you get to mount because their guards are too good and you're not experienced enough. It's like, how do you get those reps? Uh-huh. So you've got to find some way to institute that.
But let me challenge you here. Okay. Because it's what you're talking about is extremely strategic approach to learning, to educating yourself within the arena of jiu-jitsu. The reality for average students, especially at the beginning of the journey, it's very different. I mean, let's be honest here for a second. We get to open mat and nobody wants to drill. Everybody wants to slap and bump and go, boom, let's smash each
for
other,
sure,
right?
For I mean, sure, right.
So like what you're saying is like, oh, that those old guys, they don't know what they are talking about. They just want to do the boring stuff, you know. That in the appealing part behind sparring in general or open mats in general is that life engagement. What you are explaining, I 100% agree with everything you're saying, but it's more of a strategic approach, and it does remove that entertainment part from it. Right now, we are working. We're not having fun.
No, I think that might have been missed. Like,
okay,
they're still doing the live training, right? So that's built into the apparatus.
Yeah,
but we're just taking a piece of the hour or whatever however long the class is, hour, the 90 minutes, whatever, where we're making sure that part of that, you know, like if you consider the live aspect, the resistance aspect, the rolling or the situational drilling, if you consider that to be the game, right? So we're forcing them to only play part of the game for that time, but it is live and there is resistance. It's just, we ask them to go progressive resistance because again, if you go, let's just play like one side's passing guard, the other side's playing guard, right? And that's the situational drill. But now you're going to go 100% using all your athleticism and gripping as hard as you can and your strength stuff. It's like, now again, you know, it's sort of missing the point because you just did it completely cooperatively.
Yep.
When we were working on passing or whatever the guard skills were, that was cooperative. Now you're going to go as hard as you can. It's going to take people a long time to learn that way. By and large, there will always be outliers and exceptions, which a lot of times people use to validate the less optimal training methods. Because if you have an athlete, if you have somebody extremely coordinated, physically gifted, just out of the gates, all they have to do is roll and they're going to be good. So I never look at them as proof positive of any training methodology. I like to look at sort of the broad spectrum of people across, you know, ages and athletic abilities. And what I'm describing works for everybody. Everybody gets better. So we still have the fun part, the live training for the athletes. They're still entertained. But the people who never are going to have that little level of athleticism still get to really go from the theoretical, can I just perform the move correctly and know what I'm doing, to I've actually got some success in real time testing this out because I got to work it with adaptive levels of resistance.
Yeah, and I think also the important part to always keep in mind is the end of the day, we do come to jiu-jitsu or to the academy to learn jiu-jitsu, right? Mm-hmm. The fun of sparring and fun of rolling, it should be almost a secondary part. Not necessarily put away. We shouldn't completely remove it from our training. But end of the day, if we are not learning and stimulating ourselves physically and mentally, then at some point we're going to quit because there is no progression. This is what people call, I'm hitting a plateau, I'm not learning, I'm moving backwards, you know, I'm stepping back, you know, they are getting better than me. And then oftentimes we don't look at ourselves as that we're not investing our time and effort into gaining more information. This is education 101. We have to be inquiring new information and solving problems in order for us to continue troubleshooting and, you know, expanding our knowledge. Am I wrong on this?
No, I think you're 100% right. So the way that I look at it, to your point about, you know, the fun part, which obviously is what gets people excited about learning, right?
Yep.
Is to me what I was describing with, some people might find that extreme. That's just my process. That when I've shared it with others, they found it like very valuable, because I've had some people actually come back to me and say, "Hey, I did that, and that really brought up my game quickly. You know, I feel like I condensed years into a couple of weeks or months of just like picking one topic and focusing on it for a while." Mm-hmm. But saying like, "Dude, you did one thing as your primary," like the roles would go elsewhere, of course, but like I would always prioritize every time I started rolling. I was laying flat on my back and open guard, right? That's what I was doing every time. But I did that. So again, that wasn't for me only personally, but it was also so I could have kind of a complete understanding, because I had so many different types of training partners with different types of games. And then I felt like I had a deep, deep understanding of everything that was going to happen along that particular path. But for me, that's fun. Or if I pick, you know, now I'm only going to work, say side control top, and like one thing I've been working, not even going for submissions right now. I just want to see how tired I can make everybody.
Yeah.
Simply with laying on them with my weight in the right place, no matter what they do, and can shut down the escapes and try and be as absolutely dead relaxed as possible. Right. So it's been another like little thing I work on every time I get there. Here's what I'm doing. And then after doing that for a while, starting to feel pretty good, then I'll say, okay, now I start to layer in some of my offense again. To me, that's really fun. And granted, this isn't something that somebody's going to do within their first few months. They need the structure of a, you know, of a formal class curriculum, so they can even know what's going on in these positions. I'm talking about somebody has a little bit more, like a reasonable amount, so they kind of know all the positions in jiu-jitsu, and now they can do this. Even if they're like an upper white belt and they're cleared to roll and everything like that, I think they can do this. But I'll just pick a topic like that. And I think it's great, because I find it very entertaining to solve problems. That's how I think people really work. I think a common denominator of people that seem to get good really quickly, it's not just athleticism, it's their willingness to really focus on and solve problems, which I think is part of what you were saying. Mm-hmm.
No, I agree 100%. I mean, being athletic or you know, having a physical attributes is helpful. But the ability to solve problems, I think, trumps that so many times in jiu-jitsu particularly. Yeah. And you know, we see this at the academy. Anytime you have somebody with engineering-like mind.
Yes, right? Exactly.
This is where those guys are dangerous. They might not know what they are doing, but like I look at them as like, oh, I better be nice to that guy, because he is going to destroy
Give him a little bit, right? Give him a little bit of time, and he's going to be a...
They scare me. They scare me because of the ability to really, you know, troubleshoot right at that moment. And that's the powerful skill, right? The mind stimulation and jiu-jitsu. You know, we're talking about a lot about different training strategies and training platforms, and how can we maximize the return for what we do every single day. But what I think a lot of people might not know, that jiu-jitsu is not the only thing that you focus on. The striking component is quite strong with everything that you offer. Take us back a little bit. Take us back. How did all this start? Which one came first, striking or jiu-jitsu?
Yeah. I've actually been doing striking much longer than jiu-jitsu.
And that's the fascinating part, right? Because everything you're sharing with us is quite deep and quite interesting. But striking is the bread and butter, if you will.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's almost like this sounds cliche to say, but it's almost like everything kind of becomes one after a while. I mean, there are obviously much different aspects of martial arts, but I feel like, you know.
So elaborate on that. We talked about it right before we started, right? And oftentimes, like these are the two separate buckets. You know, like I'm the striker, I'm the grappler, you know, I'm the gi guy. We separate people in these categories, but what you're saying, this all bleeds over. This is one big thing. How do you justify this?
Yeah, I mean, well, what I'm kind of referring to is just the fundamental principles of human movement, right? One of the things kind of taken to say with a friend of mine, one of the SBG coaches, super smart guy over in the UK named Glenn, is, you know, kind of use this terminology between the two of us, which is like jiu-jitsu doesn't exist in a vacuum, you know, so we'll start to talk more along using language from biomechanics and exercise physiology, which isn't my primary wheelhouse, right? I've had to learn some of these things, and I'm not an engineer, I'm not an expert, but it's been very helpful because it kind of strips away some of the, you know, almost like the mysticism when people start talking about jiu-jitsu technique or striking technique as though it exists in some other domain. It doesn't. It's, you know, we exist in mechanical objective reality, right? So, in that sense, I just start to see that there's pattern recognition, and, you know, we're dealing with movement and all the different planes available to human beings, human movement of the body. And then you have two human beings. So there's always going to be an orientation based on range. And are we standing? Is, you know, are we attached or unattached? Is there any sort of connection? Is one on top of the other on the ground? You know, it's like, you know, things start to become smaller the more that you look at the principles, but then there's so many infinite possibilities. And I think that's what throws people, so, you know, then they start saying like, oh, there's so much out there to learn. And, so just in terms of history, I've kind of told this story before, but, you know, I went way back to traditional martial arts started off with the only thing available at the time, which was Japanese form of karate. And then I wound up training with some other styles of karate and kung fu and things like that for a while, just trying to seek out whatever I could. And then, of course, the big thing happened. You know, we all grew up idolizing Bruce Lee, and then the UFC thing. Yep. And then all of a sudden, complete paradigm shift.
Yep.
And as I started to ask the people that I was training with about what I just saw, meaning Royce Gracie doing what he did, and then starting to immediately read the articles and all that stuff, Horian with his, you know, monthly article and whatever, which one of those magazines where he was talking about, you know, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu and then the Gracie in Action tapes. And so I just started to read all that stuff and realized he was making very logical arguments. And of course, he was marketing the Gracie name and the brand and everything and waking people up to what they were actually seeing in the UFC. It was brilliant. But then I started asking the people I was training with, you know, well, what about, you know, about this? And I was like, their answers weren't good. Their answers didn't wash with me. So I feel like this is the point where this sort of the inflection point where people either were making this choice of kind of fall back into delusion and make excuses because they had sunk costs for all the time, energy, and investment and status that was wrapped up in what they'd spent years doing. Or they said, nope, truth is truth. There's something here that I need to learn if I actually care about reality with what I'm doing. You know, if I actually say that what I'm doing is self-defense, not just I'm doing karate for personal development or whatever, but because I actually care about, can I actually use this? So I'm going to go this way and I'm going to actually learn that stuff. So it gradually brought me there. But the problem is at the time there was availability as an issue. So
you mean
very little.
It was not available on,
right,
on demand.
Yeah.
Right?
And I'm East Coast. So it was like less available.
Yeah.
And,
go back a little bit.
Sure.
Talk about that. So how much striking experience do you have by, you know, 93, 95, when UFC 1 is happening, when Royce Gracie is making this unique presentation?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I was doing karate, and I always wanted to do martial arts, but there was just nothing good around me where I was growing up. I grew up in, like, way up north in New Hampshire. So the moment it became available to me, I dove in, and so, you know, like, this means really nothing now, but I was in my karate Taisotokan, the school. I was the fastest ever person to get promoted to black belt, like 2.5 years and stuff. And it was like, yay. Yeah. And then I saw the UFC and I was like, and kind of, so what? You know, I'm not trying to be disrespectful.
No,
I'm just saying I cared about, you know, I wanted to, you know, you don't play basketball or football or whatever because you want to just be able to pretend to do basketball or football, right? You want the aliveness, you want the skill, right? So when I realized that, and by the way, I also had a couple of wake up moments where I sparred with people who were like boxing, kickboxing. Mm-hmm. And I realized really quickly, my skill set was, it only worked when other people were playing the same game as me. The moment somebody's got a skill set where they're actually training alive and they're not playing the same game as me, my skill set fell out the window. So that was another just proof positive. So basically, my first, because of availability, my first thing was kind of going in the direction of which a lot of the people who were kind of first generation SBG coaches that all kind of found each other and formed this grassroots organization or joined it. We all had like a kind of a JKD, Jeet Kune Do background, mm-hmm. where we liked the idea because it was very much like a proto MMA Valetudo idea about, you know, being skillful everywhere and using what works and finding your own personal style and all those things. So I got into that and I was doing some kickboxing, got into the JKD. Then that led to sort of like that whole JKD concepts branch, which was then everybody's doing, you know, we were doing Filipino martial arts and all this stuff. But again, I learned doing that really quickly that even after training with, you know, some high level people in that domain, that what was really fleshing out in sparring against resistance was, again, it was not a lot of the theoretical energy drills and all that stuff. And it wasn't the stick counts and stick patterns. It was really fundamental, like boxing, kickboxing, grappling, Muay Thai, wrestling, you know, it's like that. So I just finally said, you know, this is it. And it was around that time I had great training where I was, because I had started to train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu with my instructor, Roberto Maia, who was, you know, he's a fantastic guy, very knowledgeable. He was a godfather, as we call it, godfather of Jiu-Jitsu in New England. He was like the first and only black belt for a long time in New England. Now there's tons, but he was the guy that started it all. And I had great Muay Thai training. So it wasn't that I needed another training outlet, but again, we sort of, I started to hear my brother, Matt Thornton's stuff out there. And like the other first generation SBG coaches, we all sort of just gravitated towards one another. I always describe him. I'm like, bro, you were like the Pied Piper because you were so vocal publicly. So we all sort of like, you know, hey, let me get in touch with this guy. This is how the first generation started. And then the organization grew from there. And, you know, to Matt's credit too, when we first got together, I brought him out for a seminar and he was super cool. And he was never like, oh, you know, come join my organization and leave your jiu-jitsu instructor or something like that. It's like, no, that never happened. I've gotten all my ranks through my home, you know, instructors. The SBG thing was like a coaching organization where I've granted some of the people in the organization get all their belts and everything from Matt. He's their primary coach. But for me, it was more like, we're all there to just pursue the truth in combat, so to speak. You know, like we're all trying to be good at striking, clinch range, jiu-jitsu, and just what works. And then how can we be able to disseminate this to other individuals in the best possible way? So we're always kind of challenging each other, sharing ideas mm-hmm. on how to disseminate that information, you know, most efficiently.
Yeah. And we had both, you know, Matt and Paul Sharp on another show.
Right,
we had
yeah.
these deep conversations with them, you know,
my
how
boys.
all of this started. Right. And, yeah. and what a brilliant minds. So you get to this point where your striking history, your striking skills essentially are being, perhaps not questioned, but they are put to test, if you will, right? If what you've yeah. done up to this point is the quote unquote reality of life, if you know, if I'm reading or listening to you correctly, right? And now we are in the point where you have to make some of these decisions, like what is this jiu-jitsu nonsense that's happening here? You know, why these guys, right. guys are so successful? If you had to pinpoint one of the striking points, or not, let me remove the striking for confusing perspective. But if you had to pinpoint one of the strong points from it during that time when you're making these decisions, when all of this is unfolding in front of your minds, what is the biggest difference between the traditional old school martial arts that you've been involved for years at that point and this brand new shiny object that's surfacing out mm-hmm. in the world with Gracie's taking lead on it and really kind of pushing it in front of everybody? What do you think would be the one big characteristic?
Yeah. One is aligned to reality and the other is an abstraction of reality. So traditional martial arts, what we broadly speak, it doesn't, when I say this, of course, I always have to qualify it because it doesn't apply to everything. You know, like I know some people that have a Taekwondo background. They can actually kickbox, you know, but again, in almost all cases, they've also kickboxed. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. So it doesn't invalidate the techniques that they know, yes. Because I use some of those techniques too. Like, I like them, but it's the delivery system. It's the actual fundamental skill set that they bring to the table that matters, not so much getting caught up in the all the semantics around style versus style. That's what I mean. Yeah. And I've known, you know, guys who come from a Kyokushin background and they're tough, you know, they're tough and they have good, like, they can spar. They're really gnarly. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, a lot of the K1 fighters came from those backgrounds, but they didn't just do that traditional training, obviously, you know, just like when people say, I don't know, like Lyoto Machida or, you know, some of the other guys that have come from those delivery systems in UFC, it was like, right. But is that what they're doing for their training only? No, they have a skill set, but you know, they come from full contact backgrounds and they're also training MMA and they also can grapple. You know what I'm saying? Like it's a little disingenuous when people start saying, oh, it's a karate fighter who's super successfully won the world championship in the UFC. He's like, well, he's not just a karate fighter, obviously. Right.
Yeah.
So broadly speaking though, what I find is the classic traditional martial arts methodologies, you know, when you start talking about one step sparring, kata, all these different things, learning this very rigid curriculum, what happened is somewhere along the line, you know, if the legendary story is true about how this was a combative, like warfare, empty hand technique or something, at some point there probably was a actual skill set there because it had to be tested in order for it to have any validity under those conditions. But then people do what they do. And as they try to codify and systematize that information, it gets distilled and diluted into this set of abstractions where now people are just going through these motions and somehow thinking delusionally that as they're raising their status, which all this gets very tied up to people's egos and status, and they're kind of raising up through the ranks of the amount of knowledge they're now accumulating, what gets lost is the actual ability to perform those skills against a real live human opponent, mm-hmm. which is why the paradox here is that if you want to be good at fighting, not saying you want to go out and get into fights, but I'm saying if you want to be good at the skill of fighting, then by definition, you would not want to learn that through a system that claims to be like, you know, street lethal, too deadly to train these techniques with a live opponent because we'd kill them or maim them or whatever. It's like, no, you should be doing something that has a sporting aspect, right? Even if you don't compete in the cage or a ring or a tournament or whatever, mm-hmm. you need to be competing with other human beings or you don't know what you can do. And if you claim you do, but you don't have that regular feedback loop, then you're bullshitting yourself, right? It's just delusional. So, you know, jujitsu, you can train it, as we know, with very close to all or all resistance. People's out is they can tap. But aside from that, it's like, you know exactly what you can do because you test it every day. When you're doing things where it's like, well, no, I'm going to pull my side kick to your knee just short of contact or just barely touch you because clearly if I did this for real, I would shatter your kneecap. And by the way, you're standing statically as I do it and waiting for me to return my sidekick. You know, it's like this is an abstraction of reality. It's not reality. So it's pretty straightforward. You know, it's like sometimes people get so hung up on this, not so much anymore because it's undeniable now. Like I think you really have to be delusional to still buy that now. I still run into people once in a while. But during that time when we were trying to have conversations and basically wake people up like out of the fucking matrix, it was like, they would just cling so rigidly to this, all these like aphorisms and ideas of their traditional martial arts stuff. And I'm just like, no, dude, like literally all you need to do so we can stop the verbal diarrhea is just go try this and see under these conditions if you can do that, because I'm pretty sure you can't.
Well, I think it was mind-blowing almost is the fact that today we are surrounded by this knowledge, right? Jiu-jitsu is so accessible almost on every corner all around the country and around the world. what you were talking about, you know, two decades ago, that was not the case.
Right.
The only thing we knew was this traditional approach to martial arts, and this brand new thing came, start raising up, and, you know, Gracie family is making big deal out of this. And that's where a lot of skepticism was coming in. And then, I mean, how many guests did we have? I mean, including Chris Howder and everybody else just coming in. It's like, listen, I used to do the traditional martial arts. I step on the mat and this blue belt just mops the floor with me. Like, I don't even know what is happening around me. Like, what is this nonsense, you know? And and then all of this continues evolving to what we have today with the accessibility to this beautiful art that we all love. You know, what's interesting about this is that you don't give up the striking. You continue studying the striking alongside with the jiu-jitsu.
And yes,
one of the big points that I hear from you is that they go hand to hand. This is almost, well, let me ask you, do you treat this as a one system? This is one cohesiveness that takes place between those two, or do you treat them separately?
This is kind of my personal thing. Like I said, in the early days of SBG, one of the things that I was attracted to is, because again, when it comes down to it, what I wanted, you know, the one thing I really credit the whole, you know, Bruce Lee philosophy and everything was that idea of truth in combat, which doesn't mean, again, I'm not a violent guy. Like I was not one to be going out and like picking bar fights and things like that. It's not what it's about. It was simply about, you know, this is before there was anybody aspiring to be a UFC fighter, because there wasn't a UFC, you know, or you know, the early UFCs was just barely around. But to me, it wasn't, that's not what I'm talking about. I just wanted to know, I loved martial arts. I wanted to be good at it. I wanted to know if it actually worked. And so I was interested in the truth in fighting. And, you know, I know some people would expand that and even specialize maybe in like the weapon side, yeah, and everything, which I'm more of a novice on that side, of just a tiny bit of experience, but it's not my biggest, like in terms of handgun stuff, like that's Paul Sharp's domain, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we do some edge weapon stuff, which is always like worst case scenario, like, cause that there's no good scenario with that stuff. But for empty hand, right, kind of picking my primary focus, early SBG was stand up clinch and ground, or stand up wrestling skill and ground, whatever you like to call it. And all of the first generation, now it's changed a bit, but all the first generation, like we all put in time on all those. So people came in with diverse backgrounds, some more jiu-jitsu, some more striking, some more wrestling, but everybody did everything. And that was just part of the ethos back then. And I very much was into that because I didn't want to have any weak areas. So for me, once jiu-jitsu became available to me through Roberto, and I had that opportunity, I was just like initially thinking, I'm going to bring up my ground game so I can supplement my striking, and thinking like I'll do it once a week. But after the first few sessions, I'm just like, I'm in love. And so it became twice a week, three times a week, mm-hmm, pretty soon five, six times a week, you know, and it became my obsession. So there was a period where I backed off of striking for a while and just immersed myself and saying, you know, I've got to get through this period of not knowing what the hell's going on and, you know, really sink my teeth in and start to get a feel for this. So I really focused on it for about a year or two where I was really barely doing any striking. But then after that, I picked it up. The other thing too, is around the same time I jumped on board of SBG, I started training with my other brother from another mother, Mark Delagrati, Sitiatong Muay Thai. And been with, you know, with Mark for 20 years now, and just, you know, very, very high level Muay Thai training, which that really, I've had some other great striking coaches too, don't get me wrong, but it's like Mark is just fantastic. So, and we really resonated. He's very much in line with the SBG approach and all of that, just, you know, kind of different language around it, but the same thing, practically speaking. So we really hit it off, and I just, it reinvigorated my love for striking. So I don't, tell my students, you need to do all of this. They can self-select. A lot of them do both domains. Some of them choose one or the other. But I just, for me, it's like I wanted to have that background of just, you know, I'm knowledgeable everywhere, good everywhere. And that was just my thing.
I was about to ask you a question, whether, you know, doing both is necessary or is it beneficial to the student? You partially answered that, but I still want you to dig deeper into this. Like, if that's the full system, why wouldn't we learn both? How come we are so hesitant to... Let me ask straight direct in. How come grapplers are so hesitant of doing striking?
Yeah, again, more than just one reason. And I think there's context based on different people's experiences as well as different people's personalities. And again, whenever we're talking about human beings, none of us are exempt from this. You know, status gets thrown in there. So if like, even among, let's say we're just talking about jujitsu, how many times have you heard somebody like, they don't want to take the gi off and do no gi because they know that they have a good grip game and now they can't use it in the same way. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, that's even just within one domain. So, you know, again, if you have some status one way, you do, a lot of people are kind of hesitant to put themselves in the other domain.
Yeah.
I went through it because I had status. Like literally I was going from the one school I trained Muay Thai and JKD when I was right before I started jujitsu, I was an instructor there. So it was like, I'd walk in there and I'd be like Norm from Cheers where he goes, hey, you know, like, it's like my instructor's right hand guy and everything. Then I go over to the jujitsu school, not far away to Roberto's place. I went in, nobody gave a shit who I was. Like I was nobody. Right.
Yeah.
And then I had my first time I ever rolled with a brown belt. It was basically like back then it was Roberto and one brown belt who had previous experience in California and moved east. And then there was like everybody else. There was only like a couple purple belts. When I started, it was like small, right? And, but I had my first role with this brown belt. And at the time, you know, it's no big deal for us now going with somebody brand new, but at the time experiencing it as a white belt, I thought it was magic because here I was coming as an instructor at the other school. And now he laid on his back with his hands like this and was just playing footsie with me. And I couldn't pass his guard. And I was trying everything I could, you know, and since I've had students say the same thing to me, but you know, the context is no big deal to us now after all these years. Right. But back then I was just like, this is insane. But instead of going, I'm going to make excuses for why, well, that's not good for fighting or something, cause I could blah, blah, blah. No, I said, I've got to learn this because I just felt like a little toddler playing with his dad and a full grown guy with years of martial arts experience. I've got to learn this shit, you know? So that's to me was part of the value system. I had to swallow my pride and my status I had elsewhere and just say, I'm going to learn this in earnest and be the beginner.
In some aspects, that's one of the biggest obstacles I think that a lot of us do face when we're trying to learn a brand new skill set. And even if you look at this at a much smaller scale, like within the jiu-jitsu, you know, there's a million excuses. I don't want to learn stand-up. I don't need it. And most of the time it's not because you don't need it, it's because you don't want to be the guy who gets taken down every 2 minutes because you don't know how to do it. And it's not to do it, right? In order for us to learn anything new, we have to acknowledge the fact that we just don't know it. We are brand new. We are just clean slate. Like there is a point of vulnerability which our ego gets in front of, and that oftentimes creates that friction. This is why a lot of students come in, I don't want to do takedowns, I don't want to do wrestling, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, I'm not going to invert, or I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do smash, I don't want to get smashed, so I'm not going to learn guard retention. I mean, how many times you've heard that before? I mean,
For sure.
It's all the time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing too, since you asked, so that's one big reason, but on a more practical side, to give people the benefit of the doubt, why maybe you're a jiu-jitsu person and you're not going to learn striking. Part of it's just maybe time. You're struggling to just get enough in to learn one thing. And then the other thing too is, again, context of what's available to you and how you're learning it matters, because there would be plenty of examples where I'd say to somebody, if this is your only option to train striking, don't do it. Because they could be an environment, and even if the training is competent, if these guys are in there going hard with head contact, mm-hmm. I would say don't do it, right? Like, well, you know, as I always tell people, this is not about machismo, and it's just, you know, we know more and more about CTE and everything now, mm-hmm. looking at long-term effects from fighters. You know, I mean, I could tell you stories, I won't name names, but like people who really got compromised years later from their careers. And it's not necessary, you know, because a lot of that damage took place in sparring because yep. of a really flawed paradigm.
Yeah.
And so I've heard still to this day, not even like students who wouldn't know better, but professional athletes that I've had to have conversations with, you know, MMA fighters and things like that, where they still say, yeah, man, like you can ease up later on, but in the beginning, you've got to know, you know, you've got to go hard and know what it's like to get hit. And I'm like, well, yeah, you can't just pity pat, right? If you want to go into a fight, you're going to get like, it's going to be a shock to the system, right? Mm-hmm. But there's other ways to build up that ability to contend with the intensity of it than just cracking each other full blast in the head over and over again. Because the bare fact of the matter is your brain doesn't develop like hypertrophy, like when you stress a muscle and then you rest and it repairs and it grows, right? Mm-hmm. Your brain doesn't do that, nor does it develop callus. There's no adaptive response. In other words, it just gets damaged. So, you know, it's like, that's why I love the Muay Thai stuff, because I mean, don't get me wrong, I've been concussed, I've been hurt, all that stuff. But by and large, what I love about Muay Thai, and especially one of the things that really drew me to Sit Yau Tong, is it's a very JKD-esque application of Muay Thai. It's very much like the intelligent, like you take damage, but I don't, right? I'm the finesse guy. I'm more about like strategy and angles and not just war of attrition. That's kind of like their philosophy. So what the Thais figured out that allowed them to actually have careers, because they fight so often, like a lot of times they're fighting like every month. That's how they put food on their table, feed their families. If you're killing each other every day in sparring, you can't fight and feed yourself or your family. So the same training methodologies that allowed them to develop high levels of skill without getting injured, so they were fresh to fight, we can take in terms of how we approach our stuff. And I would argue not just Muay Thai, but it's a great template for jiu-jitsu as well, to not get injured. So we can go to work the next day, so we can go to school the next day, so we're not like trying to eat through a straw in the next 20 years, you know? Yeah. It's a great paradigm.
What you're talking about is longevity. That's essentially yes. it. And I think that's the big, big appealing factor today. It wasn't like this 20 years ago in jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. You know, today I think jiu-jitsu is accessible to all kinds of ages. You know, we have students in their 50s, 60s. You know, if yeah. you're looking on internet, I mean, it's, I know Gary's 95, you know, he's still training, barely, but he's still training.
I'm up there.
You know? But that's the appealing factor, that the entry point for even us being older is available. Now, how we train.
Yes. Yeah.
That is really up to us and up to the systems that we are entering, up to the classes or the you know, curriculums or however this is structured within each academy. But this is where we need to make some intelligent decisions for ourselves, right? This is
100%.
Where, you know, I often tell my students, you know, if I had to choose you training twice a day for the next 20 years or six times a day for the next 6 months, I'll choose the first one anytime.
Absolutely.
I would rather you train for next 2 decades, you know, even if that means you're sacrificing your training time right now, because the longevity of training is by mm-hmm. far more important to me, you know. And I don't know about you, but I know when I was starting over 2 decades ago, man, we didn't think that way. It was balls out to the wall, destroy the guy in front of you, have fun at it. And if you came back next day, you were tough enough. I mean, that's how I was brought up. And, you know, things have changed since then.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I have all the injuries to show for it.
Oh, it's,
you
know? Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of the paradox of jiu-jitsu. I mean, I look, as I'm told, I guess, I look fairly young for my age, but
You do.
But if you knew what my joints were like, you know, like, right. I mean, in my late 30s through to my early 40s, I went through a period of a number of years that I could barely train. And it was one of the most frustrating things because I had totally independent. There was no collaboration between them, but I had my general doctor, an orthopedic specialist, and my chiropractor all independently tell me, you know, you really should stop doing any, basically what they're saying is live training and just, can you just teach?
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, you're killing me. Like this is, you got to cut off my legs like before and probably not even then, you know, like, but it did take me years because especially with my neck and my back, if I had a injury training with a pretty famous professional fighter, who was bigger than me. And it was just one of those fluke things that, on a attempted sweep, he was, contorting his body to keep his balance. And right as my head posted on the mat, his whole body weight came here and it was like, crack, sounded like somebody breaking kindling. And I immediately knew something was wrong. And, I had such bad, I already had like some instability in my neck and kind of just from the architecture that I have, it would have a propensity to like get subluxed and go out and I get stuck and everything, but that put me over the top. And so it'd be a thing where I'd do all the PT and all that stuff. And then I would be like, okay, I've rested for a month. I haven't trained. I've only taught class. Can't wait to get back in there. I feel pretty good. I'd go in and within like 60 seconds of rolling somebody, they'd maybe just post on my head, neck would pop. I'd be totally locked up. It would be another week. And I just went through that for years. It was very discouraging because I really wondered. Yeah.
Let me ask you flat out. How do you prevent this? What do we need to do, you know, being, you know, in the second part of our life, whether that's 35, 40, 45, 50, it doesn't matter. You know, we have wear and tear. We had, who was talking about wear and tear?
A couple of different people, Bernardo.
Bernardo was talking about wear and tear. It's like not how long you train, but the wear and tear really that kills you, right? That's what picks you apart, right? What can we do?
Mm-hmm.
What are the main strategies in your mind for us to have the longevity of training?
Yeah, well, this was really the inception point of 40 plus BJJ, right? When I like, because I was, again, if you were kind of looking not at my biological age, which I was when I started, it was around that time, but it was more, I felt like 15, 20 years older in terms of my joint damage. I was feeling the pain of that demographic and hearing the language. Cause you know, it was not just me, but my students, some of my students were older, like you said, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. And sometimes even up in the 70 range. Mm-hmm. And so you hear like what they're going through. And so I just basically the premise of it wasn't that there's a special jujitsu for people that are that age and over. What it really was about is what, you know, I now kind of refer to as first principles jujitsu, which is what is the most efficient way to learn and apply this art? So in other words, stop trying to like approach it like a young gun, like 25-year-old that's just like kill, kill, kill. Like you said, we used to be, cause that was what you did. You thought like, this is the only way I'm going to survive on the mat, you know? And so, and instead just think about where you can really be trying to do a lot more with less and be problem solving oriented as opposed to just go in like physical attributes. So one of the things we talk about specifically is stripping out physical attributes to whatever degree is possible. That's not linear. It's a sliding scale because obviously it depends on a lot of factors, including skill acquisition. The more skilled you get, the more easily you can use less energy, right? So we have to manage expectations there, but everybody, even white belts, can go a long way. The tough part with it is it takes two to tango in a lot of cases. Because let's say you're trying to do that, but then your training partner's going ham and escalating using all of their physical attributes. Cause I'm not even talking about necessarily going slow. I'm just saying, you know, can we, if we're winning an exchange in jujitsu and rolling, based on how fast we are, how strong we are, right? How good our grips, you know, are. We've got crazy grip strength, right? We've got crazy isometric strength, how explosive we are, or even how freakishly flexible we are, right? Just understand you can get away with it. You won, but there's diminishing returns, and the degree or extent to which you rely on those physical attributes beyond the bare minimum that's necessary, which will typically be about maybe 70-80%. If you're going past that, then it's at the expense of your jiu-jitsu. So this is one of the things I think is a big misconception. Like to the point where in my 40 plus community, I did a whole almost an hour long thing just on this, where I basically took all the, what I saw to be like the logical fallacies around the how much strength to use in jiu-jitsu argument. And by that implication, like other physical attributes too. And I just kind of like went one by one and addressed them all, because I think even people who I highly respect sometimes get the context wrong, because like a lot of times, I'm digressing for a second, but I think it's important to your question about longevity and how to approach it. I hear a lot of people, including older guys and including really smart, very accomplished jiu-jitsu people, say it's okay to use your strength as long as you're also being technical. Or, you know, if you can roll for 20 minutes straight at a high degree of intensity, then why not? Like, you're being technical. And so my answer to that is, and a lot of times hand in hand with that will be, look at all the top jiu-jitsu guys, right, that compete, whether we're talking about submission grappling, IBJJF, whatever, they're all physical studs, like they're all jacked. Yes, I strength train, absolutely. I do it to stay healthy and to stay intact, right? It really supports all those injuries, and it helps prevent further injuries and everything. And it's just good for your health. What I try to do very little is to rely on it in jiu-jitsu, because I want to solve problems in jiu-jitsu with jiu-jitsu, not with my physical attributes. Yeah. Because I'd rather not be successful in this exchange today, to your point about the long game, like when you were saying twice a day forever, or, you know, six times a day for 6 months, right? I would rather lose because of, you know, I didn't do that than win when I was basically compensating for a lack of a technical solution. And it took me a while to make that not just an intellectual thing, but to actually put it into practice. But now what I think is an advantage is we try and reinforce this from day one with my students. So, you know, we'll often, you know, do things like basically say, you know, during your role at any point, could you stop and have a conversation? Or are you breathing too rapidly? Say, at any point, if you feel like you're fighting through a wall and it's extremely difficult, like you're just doing this, or you're over-relying on your grip or something like that, death gripping, getting the, you know, the cramped arm, like find another way. That's your feedback loop to say that door is closed. Where's the open door? You know what I'm saying? And so we try and like reinforce this a lot, to the point that it becomes systemic and self-correcting. So after people experience that for a while, then it starts to be not just they have to remind themselves to do it, but now it starts to become sort of part of their apparatus. Like it feels wrong if they are forcing it or they are being too explosive. Some people get it quicker than others. I got to say, it's like day one, 100% successful, but it really helps. And the other thing that I thought was a fantastic observation, so as far as competition, I'll just throw this in there too. But when people say, look at all the top athletes, they're all jacked. Yeah, because they're competing. They're essentially professional athletes, right? You can be damn sure that if everything else is equal, and I'm going to, like, say I'm trying to go and compete and, you know, against some of these guys that like their goal is to become a grappling champion. If I'm going to enter that domain, I need everything. Yes, I'm going to use all my physicality in those matches, plus my jiu-jitsu. But for learning, right, in the practice room, this is one of the things I think that like New Wave gets really right. And I'm not saying they're the only ones, but I think one of the things that impresses me a lot about that is when you watch the training footage is they're doing exactly what I'm saying. Like, it's like watching a really intelligent wrestling room, which, by the way, I think some of the best like collegiate wrestling rooms, like they got this right way before jiu-jitsu, is they're being competitive, but they're flowing and they're not forcing things. Yeah. Right. It's not one or the other. They're doing both. They're being competitive, but they're also, they're not relying on the muscle. You see this jack guys like Gordon, right? But he's not muscling his technique, but they are being competitive. You get so much out of that type of drilling. And it just shows that it's possible even at the highest levels. And there's a reason why, you know, you see that level of success when maybe other guys are just trying to go 100% just deathmatch every training session.
Yeah. So, and what you're talking about is intelligent training. That's essentially what it is, right?
If you go balls out
every single time, it's what you were talking about Muay fighters. If you go balls out every single time, you can't put foot on the table. It is what it is, right? More intelligence. Yeah. The purpose behind training is not to kill each other. The purpose behind training is to get better so you can perform when it's necessary, right? Like oftentimes, you know, a few months back, somebody said, like, listen, look at other professional sports. Football players, they don't play football game every single day. No, they practice plays to put it together on Sunday night. That's just how it's work. In jiu-jitsu, we used to have a very different approach. Now we are getting by far smarter with this. And I'm hoping that a lot of our listeners really will take this to heart and start implementing this in their own training, because I think that's really what will take us much farther, much quicker. That return on that investment is going to be tremendous.
Steven, go ahead. But I think to that point, I'll just say one other thing. I had my... I'll see him again soon, but last year had a phenomenal session as always with Henry Akins, a very good friend of mine. Just phenomenal. You really understand why it's been a massive accelerant for me on all the things that I already was into, you know, in terms of the first principles approach, like just having that direct exposure to, you know, to the Hickson jiu-jitsu and all these things that people banter around, like, oh, the connection and stuff, invisible jiu-jitsu, it's real, you know? Yeah. And so it's been about 8 years now that he's been a close friend of mine, and I've been, obsessed with that. And then, you know, all basically taking all these things, and then it just becomes infused into the apparatus of all the curriculum, you know, along the philosophy that I've been talking about, the first principles jiu-jitsu, the 40 plus jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. But what was great, we had a great session last summer, and the conversation at the very end was around sort of, I think I was asking something to the effect of, you know, what's the biggest, a lot of, you know, the hidden jiu-jitsu details and stuff, of course, but like, what's the biggest thing that you kind of see as you're traveling around now, doing lots of seminars and things and seeing so many different styles of jiu-jitsu, like, what do you kind of see is where you feel like there's the gap? And his answer was relaxation. Mm-hmm. So like directly tied to what I'm talking about is he said, it's not that people aren't efficient, because obviously there's these guys that are, their jiu-jitsu is gnarly and they can roll flat out in competitive sessions, one round after another with killers, not get tired, you know, they're clearly conditioned and clearly they have good jiu-jitsu because look at their records. But yet what I really notice is they carry too much tension in their body. And I just found like that was big for me. I mean, that might seem like something it'd be easy to just kind of breeze by, but every time to me, those are the gems where you just kind of go back and say, tomorrow, where am I holding a little more tension in my body than is necessary? It doesn't mean as rigid as like, I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. I haven't done that for years, but basically the answer is how much should you use? Only ever just enough.
Yeah.
And you're constantly trying to assess just enough. And he's a great example of it. Cause if you ever like moved around with Henry or something, I mean, it feels like you're basically dealing with a moving sandbag 24/7. And, you know, so it's like, this is the goal that I want to try and get, not people that have been training for 20 some years or 30 years, you know, like we have, but like, I want my white belts to start to understand this. And then my white belts are going to be half the time and less injuries, you know, like they'll get skilled in half the time with less injuries. So
that's the beautiful part about the evolution of jiu-jitsu, that we continue getting better as instructors, as practitioners, and as all this continues going, you know, I'm hoping that our students can achieve the same success, if not better, in a half of the time that we have, right? That's at least my goal as an instructor. Steven, we've been at this for over an hour. Man, time is flying by. What an amazing conversation. Before we start wrapping this up, what we do at the end of every episode, we have a question from our previous guest that he asked, but he didn't know who's going to answer it. So it's completely in blind. Interesting. This is going to be interesting spin to the end of this conversation. Gary's going to take a lead on this.
Yeah, so this is somebody who I think has a very a mindset very much like yours. This is from Steve McKinney, and he wants to know...
Steve's my boy.
He wants to know, how do you train for your jiu-jitsu? I can't talk. Yeah. Your jiu-jitsu outside of jiu-jitsu.
I don't know if that's a philosophical question or like a straight, like kind of physical question. But
we don't know. Take it whichever way you like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you want me another hour, I'll answer philosophically. I'll just go for this straight up.
Yeah.
So
hit it.
Steve is a really smart strength trainer.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that the same approach that he uses with his clients is the approach that I have had the best success with, that I wish I was doing all along. And the irony there is that for a while I was a personal trainer, and years and years ago, and the approach that he uses that I now use, even though it was a little bit of an earlier version of it, but that's what I was doing back then. And then I got completely away from it, and I got into all like the, you know, the functional stuff, and then, you know, trying to do like the CrossFit stuff and everything. And, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, kind of spar with people over protocols and stuff, but I'm just saying, like, in terms of first principles, in terms of efficiency, like we're talking about with jiu-jitsu, the best results that I've personally ever gotten is now that I'm at the half a century mark by virtue of like my body comp stuff, like, and feeling better. So I still got the joint pain, but like physically I feel better than I felt, you know, 25 years ago. And I work out far less in my supplemental training, far less than I ever did before. So it's extremely time efficient, extremely effective. And yeah, so it's kind of like almost bizarre that Steve would be the one to ask that question because it's that like direct link to that particular approach of exercise.
Yeah, so he had no clue you were going to be answering.
Yeah, this is a happy coincidence. I love it.
Yeah. All right, Steven. Let's start wrapping this up. But before you go,
thank you so much, guys, by the way.
Thank you.
Great. Briefly, thanks for the insights, Thomas. It's great. Like
I love these conversations. I mean, such a deep, you know, deep knowledge that you bring to the table. Where can people connect with you before you run? Where can people connect with you? Talk about, you know, your website, social media. Throw it in there. And obviously, as always, we'll post everything in the show notes of this episode if you guys want to connect with him directly.
Yeah, for sure. Instagram, I am... I think it's Coach Whittier, Coach.Whittier, 40plusBJJ.com. This migrating that, but the main thing is for all my instructionals, which I've got quite a few, and there's the 40-plus jiu-jitsu series that basically led into a whole bunch of instructionals that were called like pillars of jiu-jitsu. And then subsequent to that, the more recent ones, I actually started calling everything first principles. Most of those, almost all of those are at BJJ Fanatics, which pretty much I just, you know, I go back many, many years, like way before BJJ Fanatics with Mike Zenga. He's a man, really good buddy of mine. I got to know Bernardo later on. But those guys are great. And I pretty much do most of my products through them. And then I have my next course that is very soon to be released that I just shot a couple weeks ago while doing seminars in Portland at Matt Thornton's place, which is going to be first principles of open guard. And I think that's going to be really, really cool for people. Matt said, you nailed it. Like you nailed open guard. So I mean, I have so much respect for Matt. So I was like, that was a, I took that as a huge, huge compliment. So I'm excited for that. I think, like I said, a lot of field testing, a lot of curriculum design went into that. So I think people will dig it. That'll be coming out through SBG University.
All right. Well, we'll make sure to post the notes or post all the links in the notes of this episode. So you guys go and get it, connect with Stephen as you like to ask questions. And then Steve, thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your wisdom, experiences and everything. And it was a great conversation. Gary.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I think it's going to help some of us older guys and hopefully some of the younger guys will listen to the years of wisdom you have. Take it easy on not only us, but on themselves, right? Yeah. So that they can have this conversation 25 years from now.
Right.
So
yeah, they won't lose anything by virtue of doing that. That's
exactly.
For sure.
Beautiful. I love it.
Let's wrap it up, guys. Thanks all for being here.
Thank you so much. Peace.
Take care, guys. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Raw Radio. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review and help us make the show even more amazing. For future episodes, check out our website and follow us on all major podcast platforms. Take care.